timer is definitely, like I said it. Yeah, I did. Okay, so my alarm will give me a 10-minute warning. My name is Brendan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Brendan.
And my sobriety date is October 18th, 1991. So I'm just a couple days shy of 30 years if I make it. Monday, right? No fronts, right? Anyways. I'll tell you though, I'm standing in a room with a lot of my heroes, and I really mean that. There's people in here that saw me when I walked in, which is irregular. I go to a lot of meetings, and there's not many at those. I'm usually the old guy, so it's nice to get to meetings where there's people with a lot more sobriety. Well, John, I see you over there. I'm not sure about quality, but you know, we'll get to that. I'm giving you a crap, John. Anyways, I love you. My sponsor's name is Kenny D. He was not my original sponsor. My original sponsor was a guy named John McBee on the east side. And then Kenny was my sponsor since about 6 years sober. So for the last 24 years, he's been my sponsor. And I'll get to that. I have about 45 minutes to pack 30 years of sobriety into there, which is not going to happen. So we'll just kind of see what comes out of my mouth as far as which parts of the story are gonna be shared tonight. I'll qualify myself though. I was raised in a very small community back then. It was a podunk town called Redmond, Washington, and I really mean that was podunk back then. There was no 520. You had to get out of town. You had to go over Rose Hill to 405 and make your way out. We were like the, you know, go down, catch, you know, cutthroat trout and crawdads in the river and that kind of stuff, you know, and making campfires and the underground fort you're always going to make in the woods, you know, and that'd just be like a mud hole and you'd cover it and forget where it was. You start again anew the next year, you know, and it was where you know, don't come home when the street lights come on, you're back home. And that's pretty much how it was. But so it was a good place to kind of grow up as a kid. It really was. It afforded a lot of fun outdoor opportunities, things like that. I will say that my house, I had four brothers, four Irish Catholic brothers with me. So five boys, my poor mother and my father. And my dad was a lawyer. He was an attorney in town. He was a city attorney. He started Redmond Rotary. He was president of Chamber of Commerce. We were very active. We went to church every Sunday. After, you know, the best part of that was, you know, sneaking down for the donut afterwards. And then we go to second donut, and that was at the mayor's or the police chief's house. Because all the politicians and all the people in power went to the Catholic Church in my community. It's just the way it was. And my dad, though, you know, this doesn't make me an alcoholic, but in that house, you know, everything looked really, really good on the outside. And I don't know how you grew up. You're like, maybe your house looked different, but mine looked really nice on the outside. You know, weeded yard, mowed, you know, all that. And there weren't a bunch of cars driving, nothing like that. House is painted, up to date, all that kind of stuff. But behind closed doors was a different story. It was not the all-American life, you know. But when you grow up in little communities like that, you know, you toe the line and you pretend like everything's okay. And my dad would come home, and I grew up in a very violent household. It had great times. I don't want you to get the wrong idea. We had really fun, good times, brothers and I. We had amazing memories on that. You know, we were talking about that recently because my dad just passed in June. My mom died in 2019, you know, and so both my parents are gone now, but we were talking about some of the good things, which is important to do, because when I got here, the focus was obviously on the bad, and it just was unbearable at that point. And I grew up in a household where my dad would come home, he'd be drunk, I didn't know it, he'd have a few more, and then he'd beat my mom because she didn't clean the bathroom, you know, or he'd hit one of my brothers, and then it would come down the line, the older brother down to the next younger brother, the next younger, the youngest. And I'm number four out of five in the pecking order. So eventually get to me. So this ladder of just violence would come down. And then eventually Kevin, my younger brother, would get it from me. And then we'd find him, this true story, we'd find him, we'd hear the dog yelping, and he'd just be in a rage like this, grabbing Freckles' fur. You'd hear the dog just, you know, and poor dog, you know, it went through a lot. Loyal as hell though. And it was very violent. And what I mean by that is, wasn't your normal like knockdown drag out fights. You know, we threw knives at each other with intent, butcher knives. And I put needles up in the carpets. When my brother walked out of the shower, he stepped on him, you know, broke out his foot. You know, they threw me down the stairs off the balcony. They hung me out the 18th floor window of the hotel in downtown Seattle. My shoe popped off. My brother had me by the ankle on the other one. And I still have a problem with heights a little bit. Not always though, you know, but sometimes it hits me and I got to put myself down flat on the ground. And so that still kind of comes. But that type of environment is where I was. And what we did is we just didn't talk about it. So when those things happened, we would just not talk about it. Because my household, if you talked about it, then you were the problem because you were bringing it up to the surface. So the rule in the house was like, look, like just move on. That happened yesterday. You know, like, why are you bringing it up now? That's old news. And so nothing ever got resolved. Nothing. So there's just this constant turmoil, resentment, anger, moments of just abject rage all over the place. You know, somebody would say something and the reaction never, you know, equaled what was going to come down. Right. And so what ended up happening is that, eventually I found alcohol. And that was when I was 13. I just got out of sixth grade. I turned 13 and I went to my buddy's house one day, this guy, Mike. And I tried a beer before, actually in like fifth grade. I snuck it to school and I one of those big Budweisers, you know, and I crushed it in the bathroom and was kind of dizzy a little bit. And that was about it. But this time I got it done. I stole a fifth of McNaughton whiskey. And my buddy Mike's mom came home, Claudia, and she brought that bottle in. And that was back when they had the Washington liquor store. She put up on the shelf. Mike went to the bedroom and then she went to do something. And I don't know why, but just for some reason in my head, just this thought crowded out all else, right? This thought just popped in my head, said, you should grab that bottle, shove it down your pants, run out, hide in the bushes, and run back, you know? And it just, there was no pause. There was no like, oh, maybe we shouldn't do this. There was no thinking. It just literally was a thought. And next thing I know, it's down my pants and I'm running out the door. And I shoved it in the bushes and the juniper bushes out there. I ran back in. I sat down. And about like literally like 10 seconds later, Claudia comes out of her room. Mike's still back there. And I control my breathing and she goes, what she do? She goes for her McDonald's whiskey to grab a little, you know, she wasn't alcoholic. She just always had like a little bit at night, you know, just a little, just sometimes she'd leave some and she was looking for it. And so what I do, what we always do, right. I tried to help her find it. We didn't find it, of course. We didn't look in the bushes or my pants. So that there's a clue, you know, but, she asked me to leave cause she thought Mike took it. And so she started scolding him and just like we do, right. We leave somebody else to pay the price for our actions. And so I bailed. And a couple weeks later, I'm at my buddy Joel's house and I remembered I had that alcohol and they were talking about, man, I wish we had something to do some alcohol or something. And I said, oh, I have some. So I went and grabbed it and Mike was there and he's like, it was you, you know, he's all pissed off. And in our early form of amends, right. It's like, oh yeah, sorry, dude. You know? And that's it, right. Amends over. And, you know, and if they talk about it, just like in my family, if you talk about it more than that, then you are the problem. So I made it very clear the discussion was over. And amongst my friends, I was more like my brothers, they taught me how to fight early since I was about four. You know, they used to say hit him twice and twice as hard. That was the rule in my family. And so I was this little psychopath, you know, in training, you know. And so that was it. It was the end of the conversation. And I started taking, you know, I remember my dad had these glasses when he come home. So I knew I needed glasses for whiskey. And so we grabbed these, you know, old Spaghetti Factory glasses. And I just started pouring. They were pouring them and I was shooting them. Pouring them, shooting, big glasses, right? And I'd take about 3/4 of the bottle of McNaughton whiskey in a rapid succession. And I'm holding it down, I'm not throwing it up, and I'm just like, this stuff sucks. It tastes like gasoline, it's horrible. This stuff, I got bunk alcohol is what I think, right? So I declare this stuff is worthless, and I step up from the lower deck, and I take one step up to the upper deck, and it's just like, poof. And it just hit me like a train. And it just like, I mean, I remember the burn in my stomach. I remember it coming to the back of my spine, my nervous system just got taken over. And for the first time, I remember this. I remember there's this, you know, you hear people describe just that, man, I felt, and when you're ratcheted up like that in my fan, like all that stuff and all that crap that was going on, I was like, I was wound up tight. I didn't realize how tight I was wound up until I took that alcohol. And it was like, it melted away. It just melted away. And I was just like, oh yes. And that was about, there was about 2 seconds of, oh yes. And then basically blackout, you know, and I have barely any recollection that night. I'd like to say I did well that night, but that's not the case. You know, when you're 13 years old on 3/4 bottle of whiskey, it's pretty messy. I was crying. I couldn't tie my shoes. So they threw me outside, like literally threw me. And I thought it was a short while. I guess it was like an hour later. I was still crying about my shoes. And so they decided to take me to the town drunk's house, our friend Heather's house. And about, I don't know, a while there, I was falling down, hitting myself on the pavement, on the parked cars. I was just a total disaster. And Mike went in, that guy where his mom had the whiskey, and went into a garage that was open. Giant motorcycle helmet he found for me, almost out to my shoulders. Shoved it on my head to protect me because I was hurting myself, you know, and they were concerned about my head wounds. And so they put it on, and then I'm just like top heavy. So wherever that thing tilted, I was diving. So I was diving like 50 times more than normal. So wherever it tilted back, I just full on just bam, you know, just I'd hit on the helmet. And I'd be like, woo, you know, just like it was a fun time. And the mask is down. I can hear my voice. And I'm yelling Star Wars junk. And I don't know why we do that, but we do. And I'm just yelling stuff. And they're just like, shh. And they finally decide it's a bad idea to take me there. So they take me back to my house and they do what I call the drunk dump, you know, where they just basically say, here you go, shove you in your property and bail, because they don't want to be associated with what comes next. And that's what Mike did for me. Mike lived right behind me a couple houses back, and he just literally shoved me in the window. I was really loud and I fell in. I didn't walk in or climb in. I just fell in. Brother Brian came out and he said, you're drunk, I guess. And I according to him, he said, I tried to grope him, make a pass at him, and called him Buffy. And Buffy's the girl that was in my high school or my junior high then. And she was very beautiful. And that was her name. And then my mom came down and said, you know, your son's drunk, Jim, your son's drunk. He said, which one? And, you know, and I went up there and I did the same thing to him, tried to make a pass at him, grope him, called him Buffy, you know. And that was my first drunk, and it never got better than that. You know, but no one died. No one went to jail. Nothing bad really happened. I mean, I got a few bumps and bruises. And the next morning my dad said, you know, I bet you don't feel too good. You know? And I'm like, oh yeah. Cause I knew by his tone of voice that meant I shouldn't feel good. But to be honest, I felt great. I wasn't like, oh, I don't feel good. I was like, I want more of that. Whatever that magic juice was, all I could think of. And so literally my obsession from day one, when I drank alcohol, I never led into this, you know, like, gradually I had a little bit built up to a, you know, six pack and a 12 pack. And this, it's just from day one, it was just, this is magic. And I chased that all the way to the end. And by the time I'm 14, I stole a keg from the battalion fire chief up the street. My buddy Jimmy was filling it, the business arrangement, which isn't a good business arrangement, but it was good for an alcoholic, is he would fill the keg, keep all the cash from the parties, which was a lot. And I would have as much alcohol off that keg that I could drink. And it wasn't that much, you know, as far as like my height, weight, and everything that was going on. I was obliterated, you know. And fast forward, you know, I'm doing other substances. I find, so morning, noon, and night, I'm doing, you know, alcohol and other things. And by the time I'm about 14 and a half, my brother Brian goes to treatment at care unit up to Lakeside Milam, does wilderness survival, comes home, and Brian's fresh skinned and anew. You know, I laugh that part in Bill's story where it talks about, here was that man, like his old childhood friend, Ebby, right? Comes to the door and he's like, here's something, the boy's on fire, all right? There's something in his eyes and all that. And when I opened the door, that literally I had that experience with my brother. It was like, he looked at me, and my brother and I were the most violent with each other because we're closest in age. We're 2 years apart. He said, hey, Brendan, how you doing? It's the first time he actually asked me how I was doing my entire life. And he was sincere and honest about it. He said, it's really good to see you. And he meant it. And it freaked me out, to be honest. I was like, what's going on? My mom went away to family weekend. She came home with a bunch of Al-Anon literature. And so my mom became this Al-Anon Nazi. And she started like, you're going to meetings and you're doing this. And I know you're not swimming with the Revan pool. And that's not why your eyes are red. And you're going to do pop UAs. And you're going to be going this. And you're going to outpatient. I'm like, what the hell happened? You know, like I haven't done anything, you know? But by the time that rolled around, I'd already stolen cars left or right of my family. We'd go out and steal liquor cabinets. And I was telling that somebody today we're talking about, where I went out, we'd steal whole liquor cabinets out of people's houses. We'd back up, like this girl would go in that she knew the house, she'd bring it out. We'd have all these plans. This is going to last us 2 weeks. You know, and it would literally in a matter of days, we'd be out of alcohol again. We could never understand. We're like, what? How do we do this? You know, and by the time I'm 15, I'm looking at my first treatment center at Lakeside. I had a class A felony assault charge because I was into lots of fights. And I pummeled this guy. My dad was a lawyer and he said, you should go to treatment. They'll give you time served maybe, because they were going to lock me up for 6 months, mandatory. And so all these people wrote letters and all this stuff. And I went to treatment, and then I went to wilderness survival for 21 days. If you don't know what that is, that's not the Outward Bound. That's where they starve you for a couple days. No shower for 21 days, no change clothes. You dig a grave every night. It's literally a shallow grave. You put rocks down, build a fire, spread the coals, bury it so you don't freeze to death at night. You have a couple lentils, rice, oatmeal, flour, milk, powdered milk, like I said, lentils, and then six bouillon cubes and raisins, right? And that's 7 days. It's a week's rations. And when you get back, you know, that's supposed to apparently jar you and make you appreciate life a lot more. And so that's supposed to help you stay sober. And I wish that was the case. But what happened was I got released out of that treatment center within a couple of weeks. I drank again. And that time was my dad's house. My mind remembered that there was some alcohol in the closet. And I remembered before I left, there was this Christmas wrapping stuff. And my mind said this, you know, you should see if that's still there, because it would be really irresponsible of your dad to leave that alcohol now that you're out of treatment. So you should find out if it's still there, just to double check. And that's all that was in my mind. No warning, no like, this isn't a good idea. And I went in there and I unwrapped it and there was Kahlua and a bottle of white wine. So I downed the Kahlua, I downed the bottle of white wine, and I did it on the swing set out back, which is a terrible idea. I was never more sick in my entire life. And that was it. I almost shot my friend that night. I had a shotgun pointed out, pulled the trigger, and my dad was a good hunter. He didn't have it loaded and it didn't go off. You know, and I stayed sober a little while longer, and then I came home another day, and then without even thinking at all, walked right in my mom's house up on the counter, moved the battery can, grabbed the liquor. It said cooking wine. I started chugging that thing, chugged about half of it, called my buddy, said, "Hey, I'm drinking." He brought down 8 beers. He said, "It tastes like soy sauce." I'm like, "I thought so too. It's terrible." So I drank it, got drunk. And I told this story with my mom speaking at Al-Anon one time. And she said, "I did get rid of all the alcohol." And that was actually a bottle of Kikkoman soy sauce. She had poured it in the cooking wine bottle. And so I relapsed by chugging a half bottle of soy sauce. But you can understand, like, I'll drink whatever it is, you know, whatever you have. You know, the thing I bought most of when I was out there, as I would steal Bacardi 151 from people's houses, that people had that a lot back then. But the thing that I bought most of, I was worried about quantity. And so I would grab lots of the Grape Mad Dog 2020. And I drink tons of that stuff, you know, because it got me there. Same with vodka, whatever I could get my hands on. You know, beer, it just took too long, right? Hard alcohol, you know, but if I had beer, it's all I had, I'd drink that. You know, my last treatment center was 91. That was DSHS. They basically said, you know, "We can't accept you. We already have somebody." My mom begged them and said, "Look, my son is not going to make it if you don't take this guy." And so she talked to this guy, Pierre Brown. He's gone now, but she begged him and he said, "Sure, come, fine, be out here in the morning." And so I did. And that was the adult program. And I was there for like 21 days. And I thought about jumping on the dinner train. I used to go by that property every day. And I look at that dinner train, I'd be like, I could run and jump on that thing maybe. And I come to find out that thing only went to Ellensburg and then back. So that wouldn't help me at all. But I got out of there and I had never done the steps. So I did 1 through 5 in treatment, but I'd never done the steps really out of the book. I did the worksheets and things like that. And there's a difference, you know, to be clear on that. And I was miserable because I'm a guy that gets worse, not better, drunk or sober. And so I'm miserable. I'm not happy about my sobriety. I'm sitting in this meeting. I'm like, screw this. These people, same relapse sobriety, same message you keep hearing, the same rigmarole, blah, blah, blah. Same thing from all these people. And I'm not feeling it, you know. And I just said, you know, I'm not feeling well. I'm just going to go home. And so I excused myself from the meeting. And I started walking away a couple blocks from my mom's house. And I looked up at the sky and I was like, you know what, God? And I'm out loud. I'm like, if you got something, better send it quick. Within 2 weeks, I was at this guy's house named John, my first sponsor. I didn't go out of there because I was desperate. I was desperate, but I told God that day, you better send something quick because I'm done here. I can't stand to watch the pain in my mom's eyes. I'm going to drink as much alcohol and do as much drugs as I can to get off this rock because I just can't do this anymore. I go to sleep at night begging God, please don't let me wake up. I don't even believe in God anymore, but I'm begging this God, I don't even believe, please don't let me wake up. Because if I don't wake up, you don't have to rewrite any history books. I haven't contributed anything. And I'm trying to justify with him, like, why I should be, you know, let out of this deal called life. And that never happened. Every day I wake up and I light a Marlboro Red and I'd be like, well, it's about the best it's going to get, right? And when I went to that guy's house, he asked me one question. He said, "Why do you think you're an alcoholic?" And the room got silent because these guys already happened to him. And I got like the big setup. So I'm looking around, they're all like snickering and I'm like, I'm going to get you guys for this one, you know? And I asked him, so I started telling him all the crazy stories, all the stuff I did, almost killing my friend, crashing cars, stealing cars, all this stuff. And he goes, "Yeah, Brent, I never did any of those things. I've done things that are crazy like that, but I never did what you're talking about specifically, but I'm an alcoholic. Why do you drink again? Why did you, you got to treat me. You told me you went to treat me. Why didn't you stay stopped? I mean, you weren't drinking. What? How'd you go back to it?" And I finally had the only answer that was appropriate, which finally was the truth. And that was, I don't know. I don't understand why I keep doing what I'm doing. And I'm going to meetings and I'm starting to believe in Alcoholics Anonymous that what you guys are talking about isn't available to a guy like me. I see you guys come in and I see these guys get sober and it seems like their lives are working out great. You know, I mean, 90 day wonders, you know, like 90 days, they got a job and a car and the girl. And I'm like, my life sucks. You know, like, what is the deal here? And these people, I would hate them in meetings. I hung out at Hilltop Fellowship Hall a lot back in those days. And these people would stand up and talk about, you know, Big Book and this and that. And then I just darts and we'd just be like, we'd interrupt them. We kicked one guy out of the meeting who was trying to invite us to this Big Book workshop. We're like, okay, Mr. Spiritual, you know, and they were like shiny, happy people in the corner. You know, they were just annoying because I'm feeling like crap. This guy's telling me how great his life is. And the only thing I can think through my self-centered, self-obsessed mind is how this doesn't relate and how I'm being reminded of how bad my life is, you know, and that's all I'm thinking. But if I hear somebody talk about the crazy life and that, I can relate. And so I think it's a good meeting, but it's not because I'm not here. I'm not attracted to the solution at that point. I'm attracted to misery. And so I'm asking all these people to sponsor me, you know, that are not going to sponsor me, because that's the great arrangement, right? Like, hey, but yeah, I'll be your sponsor. And then we never talk, right? We hang out at the same meetings, but that's my sponsor, but we didn't do any work that was sponsor related. And so what ends up happening is I go to this guy's house, we start going through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous page by page, start at the title page, go all the way through the book. And in that book, I'll tell you this, like I'm coming up on 30 years and it blows my mind that I'm one of the ones that made it. Probably to you too, Jeffrey. You know, because back in the day, I'll tell you, I know for a fact no one was betting on me making it. And I really mean that, because later, that's not just a joke. Literally, we had conversations later when I was years sober. And they said, yeah, man, we literally wrote you. We thought, no way this kid's going to make it. He is absolutely insane. There's just, he's one of those people. They really thought, they kept, but I remember this conversation, Jeffrey's sitting by right here, but John was like, John told me, he's like, yeah, I used to call Jeffrey and I'd be like, I don't know what to do with this kid. And Jeffrey would just remind him, he's like, it's not up to you. You're not going to save him. Just read the book, go through the steps. That's God's job. That's not your job. And John didn't give up on me. He kept meeting with me and he kept feeding me, spoon feeding me these pages in this book. And he'd ask me, he said, does your experience validate what's in this book? That was one of the most important questions he ever asked me. Because what I kept trying to do is have your experience. I listened to your experience in meetings and I tried to have what you were talking about. And he said, stop. He goes, have your own experience, right? Like, does this make sense to you? And he'd make me look up words that I thought I knew. And that was really annoying. He actually even had me look up the word never. I mean, who doesn't understand the word never? You know? But he had me look it up, because in the doctor's opinion, he said that never happens to the average temperate drinker, this phenomenon of craving. And it finally explained to me why I would go out and why when I started to drink, I had little or no control of the amounts I took. Why is it when I took a drink, I would drink until there was nothing left or my body gave up? And why would I wake up the next day and that mental obsession be on me and I'd go back to it again? Why after almost dying and being in the Valley General Medical Hospital with IVs hooked up to me, and they gave me 8 hours max, and it wasn't drug related, it was alcohol. I was like literally just, I was malnutritioned is what they came up with. And I'd stopped drinking water or eating, I didn't care. And I literally was in there and they gave me a nutritionist. That was my problem. I needed to learn how to eat properly. And I remember leaving there with the braces around my wrist, and I was drinking later with that stupid thing. And I looked down, I was like, oh man, you know, but that doesn't stop me, you know, as an alcoholic. None of those near death things do. So what ended up happening to me is that, you know, John, when he took me through, I finally understood the first step. And I was really angry at God when I came in here. When you talked about God, like I said, the shiny, happy people, the spiritual people, people talked about God and were happy, really annoying. And you said, Brandon, you set all that aside, set all of it aside for a new experience. Honestly, ask yourself what these things mean to you. So one night I found myself getting in my bed and I promised I would pray and I laid in bed. I got all done. I'm like, oh, I forgot to pray. I said I was going to pray. So I got out of bed again. I got back out of bed. It seemed to me it was like a big task. So I'm being dramatic about that, because at that point in my life and my thinking, it was like, oh, I gotta get out of bed again. I just got out of bed, you know, I'm a warm, you know, excuse my language, you know, it's like, you know, this is this AA stuff. And I didn't believe it was gonna work for me. That's the funny thing. I did not believe what you were trying to tell me in this book was gonna work. I thought, no way this is gonna work, but I'll try it. And so I got up and I just said, I questioned putting my hands together. I said, I'm okay with that. I questioned getting on my knees and said, you know what, it's universal, everyone, all religion, spiritual people, it's just a sign of humility. Fine, I'll do that. So I got on my knees, but I questioned that. And I finally looked out at the sky, saw the moon and some clouds going by. I said, hey, I didn't know what to say. So my first honest prayer was like, hey, I'm Brendan. I didn't know what to say, you know, because I didn't want to do all my set prayers I'd grown up with. I wanted something new. And so I just said, hey, I'm Brendan. I felt stupid. And this is the funny thing I always point out, is that all the crazy behavior I did, I should have felt embarrassed about out there. I never did. But here I am alone in my mom's basement. No one's around. No one can see me. No one can judge me. And I feel ridiculous talking out to the night sky. And all I can think of is what people would think of me if they could see me doing this now. I was obsessed about what other people would think of me, even when I'm sitting here alone in the dark. And I didn't realize, but that little conversation that I started, and that goes back to the something that old timers used to talk about. Actually, you and I talk about that just start where you're at, right? Just start where you're at. You can't start anywhere else other than where you're at. I was always trying to get to a certain point or feel a certain way or believe a spiritual thing, and then I would start that path, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, it's just nothing but failure from that point. And so when I honestly asked myself and I started to do that, then it gave me the power then when in my third step, and I honestly didn't believe it was going to work for me. I just said, okay, God, here we go. And I did my fourth step. And I wrote all the people I hated, which was everybody. I hated everybody. And that became clear, you know, and I had stuff on there. I always bring up this example to sum up all the inventory is basically I had people on there. One of them said, people who drive by and stare at you with that effed up attitude. And John just looked at me and goes, are you, what? And I'm like, yeah, man, you know, like people drive by me and they always look at me. And I don't know if it's long hair, Metallica, Kill 'Em All shirt. And I had this medicine pouch from Wilderness Survival. I was out there, ate a mouse when I was out there, and I brought the mouse fur back in my little medicine bag thing. And they started calling me Rat Boy in AA. So I'm a personality, right? You know, so I'm Rat Boy, you know, and but that's only good for a while and it wears out, you know. And I didn't know you're not supposed to tell everybody what's in that medicine pouch. But of course, you know, being the grandiose, you know, and, you know, egomaniac, I was like, hey, I want to see my mouse pouch. You know, I want to see my medicine bag. Yeah, it's a mouse fur. I ate it. They're just like, ah, you know, like freak out. And after a while, they're like, yeah, yeah, we heard you ate a mouse. You ate a mouse. That's great for you, buddy. You know, and but I was really happy to tell everybody about it, you know. And but that so I get through all that. But I had this resentment. He's just like, you got to be kidding me. And I'm like, no, man, I swear to God, this is real, because I thought I had that. Aha. There's nothing in my fourth column, because you know what? That's what they're doing, and I'm not crazy. I know I'm crazy, but not on this one. This is for real. And he just said, Brendan, how do you know they're staring at you? I'm like, well, because they are. I mean, you could tell. You could see them. He's like, how do you know? And I interrupt him again. He's like, stop, pause. And he had gone to the 10th, 11th in that part in the book, you know, 86, 87, 88. He started there with me actually early on. Said, you need to start practicing this now. I know you're not there, but if you don't do this, you're never going to make it. If you don't start doing this now, you're never going to make it. And so he tried to get me into practice. And a discipline, as it talks about. And so I paused. I'm like, okay. I'm like, humming. John, here we are. I'm in my inventory. I'm already aggravated. And all of a sudden, this thought pops in my head, you know, in that quiet 1 second, you know, of like quiet that I could muster. And it's just, I hear this thought and just said, you're staring at them. And it was like, because it's impossible for me to know if they're staring at me unless I'm staring at them. But it was, I was blind to that obvious fact until that moment. And up until that moment, they were doing this to me. I never thought, oh my God, I'm staring at them and they're looking back, reflecting back what I'm doing. And they're just looking back at me going, are you okay? You know, like driving by, like, what's wrong with him? You know? And I'm like, I'm just looking at him like with this look, like, I'll kill you, you know? And, you know, like pull over. Didn't care who it was. I didn't care if they're old, young, whatever, huge guy. I didn't care. And, you know, but I get through that. It's like, oh my gosh, this whole thing, everything I'm having problems with, I'm drawing it into my life. It's being reflected back to me. And when I saw that, I thought, my God, I'm causing my own misery. This thing it talks about in the book, they're not theorizing, right? The spiritual life. They're not just telling me these things. And it's this grandiose stuff or out there, you know, it's like, I'm really living this. Oh my God, I'm this guy in the book. And so when my story started to relate and match up so closely to what's in that big book, I started to have that experience they talked about. And I started having these moments where I would start to see the character defects as they're approaching some things that were about to happen. I'd be like, no, 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 no. I hear this, just this quiet, but like, hey, Brendan, just a little knock on my consciousness of like, you're about to do that. It's like, oh yeah. And it was just these moments I would have, just brief moments. And I didn't succeed every time. I mean, I chased a guy through Redmond about 80 miles an hour downtown one night, and I was going to kill him, you know? And then all of a sudden this voice, when we're going out there, you know, I hear this voice just like, what are you doing? You know, like really quiet, just what are you doing? And I let off the gas and I pulled in the turn lane and I went back 25 miles an hour all the way back to my mom's house. But my old behavior, I had my light on. I was looking at him in the mirror and I was like going like this, going like, I'm going to kill you. And I made sure he knew, like, you're dead. I have a full tank of gas. You're so screwed, you know? And I know all the back roads and I got four-wheel drive. So good luck, buddy. You know, you're done, you know? And I just drove back and I just like that rage just left me. And I just thought, I got into peace. And I'm like, what am I doing? That's crazy. That's absolutely insane behavior. You know, if I started to now draw the conclusion that that type of mental life and thought life is going to lead me back to drinking, that's the problem with that. It's not that it's going to cause me problems with the police and the courts and all that kind of stuff, because it will. But that type of thinking that had a grip on me, that type of behavior and thought life is going to separate me from my fellows and separate me from God. And if that's the only thing keeping me sober, I'm screwed. That means I'm vulnerable, because the next thought will come. Is I'll just be, for whatever reason, doesn't matter. Like I've already told you, I just walked home and I drank without even thinking, or I struggled a little and I drank, right? When I had those things come, that's what was going to happen to me. And I didn't want to live that way anymore. In my last fight, I was sober, actually, from where I live now. I looked out, I was Kenmore Lanes. It was the last time I ever got in a fight. And I was in my inventory at the time, you know? But I remember I wept after that. I beat the holy hell out of this guy and I just felt terrible. And, you know, and I never had a fight since. You know, I don't walk around like that anymore. I'm not that guy. You know, I'm the guy I'll be like, hey man, go ahead. You can punch me in the face. I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to walk away. It's not worth the cost to me anymore. The personal loss that I'm going to have is just not worth it. And it's painful to me. It's painful to me to even think back. And I made amends to all those guys that I got in fights with. You know, I made amends to one guy. He was so happy to tell me that Japan made this new epoxy product for his bridge tooth because I punched him. And that was the guy I was looking at the felony assault, one of them. And he could finally eat an apple without taking his tooth out. He was all excited to tell me. And I'm just thinking in the middle of amends. And he's all excited to tell me. I'm just like, oh, I affected this guy's life forever. You know, he hasn't been able to eat an apple his whole life since I popped it out when I punched him since that to that day. And the other guy I made amends to for that, one of the other amends I made to, this guy Chris, and he broke down crying in the store. I asked him, is now a good time? He said, yeah, we were over in McDonald used bookstore in Redmond. And he just started breaking down crying. He says, you know, after that, because he was a huge guy and I'm just a little guy and I beat the living hell out of him. And he's like, you know, my dad never let me live that down. And I remember in the office when he kept looking for the guy beat him, he goes, who? And I was the only one there. And he goes, who? And he's looking past me. He goes, that little guy? And he berated him in the office in front of everybody. Just rode him terribly. And I was like, and at that point, I had no remorse for that guy. I was like, yeah, that's right. You know, and I was evil back then. But then at that point, when I'm talking to him, we're both crying in McDonald's used bookstore. And he's just like, he's crying, I'm crying. And I'm realizing that his dad never let him down. And his dad to that day had, he's like, all I wanted was a sincere apology. And I said, if I haven't made it clear, I'm so sorry. And he asked me to help. He said, hey, would you talk to my sister? She's on heroin and we're afraid we're going to lose her. Mm-hmm. And you know, and that guy that where he talked about the epoxy, he asked me to take him through the steps. Every time I went to make amends, it was the weirdest thing. It was like, I was like this little AA ambassador. Somebody's asking me to be of service, to help somebody in their family, somebody they knew because they knew me before and they saw me in front of them. They knew there's no way that that guy is this guy today. You know, there was this old mentor of mine, his name was Don. He used to say, there's a man to bring to prison and there's an ex-con. And I love that explanation because the ex-con's going back. He's still got the mental attitude and all that stuff. He's got prison on. The ex-con is just a man who's been to prison. You know, he's no longer that guy anymore. And so who I am today and what I am today is I am not the Brendan that walked in here. In fact, the guy that walked in here wasn't even Brendan. I'll go so far as to say that. My true nature and who I really am when I walked in here, that was not me. What you had was somebody who was in untreated alcoholism, was completely screwed up, who had a lot of baggage from his upbringing and all that stuff. And I have sought outside help and stuff for that. I will mention that, you know, the steps were great and they gave me a lot of relief and they helped with some things, but I also did some counseling on that. And, but from that, you know, I got into, you know, after that, amends and finally making amends to my mom. And I'll tell you this, when I made amends to my mom, I was convinced that she was going to make me work for peanuts the rest of my life and pay back all this money and, you know, taking the car and robbing the place to cover up for it. And my sponsor, John, that was when he could hang up on people, you know, he could actually clang the phone. And John said, you'd be so lucky if she'd let you. And he'd bang and he'd hang up on me. And it was true because I sat down, I made amends to my mom. The only comment she said was, oh, honey, I'm just glad you all survived. She had five sons. You know, I had four brothers, five sons, and three of us were in active alcoholism and addiction. You know, my brother Brian was still sober. I was now sober. My younger brother Kevin was sober at the time. And what dawned on me is that the impact I've had, like those guys I talked about, the impact for the rest of life, it never occurred to me that there was an impact from that day forward that drastically changed and altered their life. My mom saying that to me, I'm glad you all survived. She didn't care about the money. She didn't care about the car. She didn't care about any of that stuff. What she cared about is that she wondered when she said goodbye to me at night when I'd leave the door and what was going on. Is this the last time I'm going to see my son? Is this the last time? What was my last conversation with Brenda? Because I'll tell you, the last conversation she had with me often was a rattling of explicatives and things and telling her what, you know, just horrible stuff that I would never say to anybody. No woman, you know, especially, you know, and she put up with so much, you know, and she did eventually put me out one day with a garbage bag, you know, and that was it. But I realized that the impact every night that I had on her and the strain and the pressure, and I was like, oh my God. You know, I made amends to other people who thought it was somebody else. I'd heard some crazy stories in AA about that where somebody had robbed a house and they thought it was their son or whatever. I heard that stuff. That actually happened to me. I went to somebody and made amends to them. They thought it was this other person and it wasn't. And I got to own that, you know. And you know, from that though, what all these things that I went through and these deep dark secrets and all the stuff off that have become a healing thing for the guys I work with. Because when I sit down with them across on an inventory or walking through life and I can say, yeah, I've been there, man. I know what you're talking about. There's a quote on 152 to 153 where it talks about that you will walk shoulder to shoulder with the new man, right? You will escape disaster together. And that's what AAS, what you guys did for me, because I walked shoulder to shoulder with my sponsor, John. Funny story, Jeffrey ran away from me at a meeting once because he was like, has he done his inventory yet? And he's like, nope. He's like, get him away from me. He didn't want my bad, untreated spiritual juju on him. And he was just like, I thought he was joking. I started chasing him around this Kirkland meeting like, oh, he's kidding. And he wasn't kidding. He was like, get away from me. You know. And but, you know, I sit down with these guys, and that's happened where I've had these guys talk about some stuff. It's pretty gnarly. And I'm able to share some stuff I never thought would be of any usefulness to anybody. I'm able to share that in that moment, their idea of God gets a little bit bigger and that problem gets a lot smaller. And they realize that if I'm a guy across from them that went through something similar and I'm okay, just maybe there's something for him too. Got a couple more minutes. So, you know, I've been able to, you know, like I said, put together, you know, just a few 24 hours, you know, doing this. But I want to tell you that currently what's going on. And that is, you know, I was a straight up student. I went to UW. I eventually, when I got sober, I found out I was actually pretty smart if I just applied myself. And I graduated with a degree in cell molecular biology, English creative writing. So I did 2 4-year degrees simultaneously. I was on Dean's Honor Roll list. My mom was taking down probation notices, putting up those things. And, you know, from that, you know, I eventually wound up in a career up north, and I was married and I had a couple kids. And I walked through a divorce, you know, a pretty gnarly divorce. And right now today, I'm actually in a custody deal because I had to file, because my two little daughters are 8 and 10. When I filed, you know, they were 9 and 7, and they were living in a rundown, broken down camper trailer thing with somebody doing meth and some other stuff. And it was a really gross scene. We'll just say that. And, so the good news out of that is that, you know, the ex fled back to her parents, so that's a very safe place. And they're not in that anymore. So regardless of what happens out of the outcome of this, I got them out of there, you know, by doing that. And we'll see what happens, you know, if they come back with me, which looks pretty likely given this scenario. But, you know, I got in a gnarly car wreck, my second back surgery. I found out, you know, I was being given the pills as directed by my loved one. And I found out that I am definitely somebody who should not ever take that stuff. Cause man, I am psychotic. She got to see for a moment the old Brendan, and I was just like yelling and screaming and threat. I was crazy. And, they got me off all that. And within 10 hours, like, what the hell's going on? You know, it was like blacked out, you know? And so it's on my chart permanently. Like, do not give this guy Dilaudid, cyclobenzaprine, and like all these things. And it literally says, like, comes highly agitated. And they ask me every time I'm at the, like, so what's this about? I'm like, I've become an a-hole. You know, and they're like, oh yeah, we've seen that. And that's all I tell them. But out of this, you know, the tools that you've given me is that I remember laying awake in the problems with the struggles with the divorce, the struggles with my kids. And you, when you're years sober and you wake up at 1 or 3 in the morning and it's on you, and you're just like, because life doesn't escape you. It's not like you get sober, yell at someone, you're like, oh, just bounces off me. Life's just whatever. You know, life happens. You know, people get married, people get divorced, people, you know die on it, you know, like all sorts of stuff, right? And there's a quote in the end of about halfway through the 10th step. It says, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. And the part that struck out to me one night when I'm laying there, this is about a month into no sleep almost, since I walked home one day and found all the stuff, you know, all their stuff gone and what the heck's going on. And I said a little prayer. I pray for peace upon her heart and peace upon her mind. And I instantly did the direction and said, I turned my thinking towards someone I could help. And what I did is what I needed was to, I needed to pray for her for a second and then not think about that anymore, because otherwise I'm just concentrating on that issue and it's just growing. And so I started just saying this mantra, I've ceased fighting anything or anyone. I ceased fighting anything or anyone. And I just kept saying it through my teeth, then through my mouth, then quietly with my mouth closed in my mind, and it would take hours. And I can't tell you how many times I said that. I'm not exaggerating. I know I said it thousands upon thousands of times, because I would just repeat it over and over and over until my body gave up and went back to sleep. My mind let go, you know. And there's this old I read some outside literature, of course, too, but there's this one thing, this author named Emmett Fox, and he wrote this thing. He said that, you know, when you have a problem, if you have a rock and you turn it upside down, the rock falls out. When you have a problem that's on you like that, you turn it upside down, it doesn't fall out, it just sticks there. So the only thing that's going to make it move is you have to replace that thought with something else. You have to push it out. And that's what I was doing. I was pushing that thought out of my head with this other replacement. And that came from Alcoholics Anonymous. What Alcoholics Anonymous gave me was a way and a tool and a way of life where no matter what's happening, no matter what crazy insanity is happening in my life, I have something to pull out of there to use in that situation to calm my mind, my thought life, because that's where this thing goes. Because if I can get my thought life and my spiritual life, if I can get that, you know, going, right, and I'm just concentrating and meditating, getting quieting the mind until I can align my thinking with God's thinking. And then I start to live in that God consciousness, that quiet, that amount of serenity that matches the calamity that's on me. That octopus on my face lets go. And I can sleep. And then I wake up and I do the next thing the next day. And it doesn't mean, there's two words my original sponsor gave me, said you need to be persistent and consistent. And that is what I've had to do. If I'm not persistent and consistent, I'm gonna pass off the scene. I'm not one of those people I see, you know, I can't judge my sobriety against somebody else's, because every one of us in here is a little different. Some of us are a little bit more allergic or less, I don't know. But I know for me, I'm very sensitive to this. If I don't do what we're talking about here, I do not do well. People around me suffer, and then eventually I will suffer, and everyone suffers even more. I have two little daughters who have never seen me drink ever. They've never seen me throw something across the room. They've never seen me punch a hole in the wall. They've never seen me chase somebody in a car and tell them I'm going to kill them. They've never seen any of that. They don't know the Brendan I've just told you about. The only Brendan they know is who I've always been. And I may not have had the best father ever and the guy that, you know, I wanted in my life, right? That never happened. That's okay. What I have is Kenny was that in my life. Kenny's more my dad than anyone else has ever been. And, you know, it's strange how that happened, you know, it's another story, but, I'll finish with this, that, the Brendan they get to see is that the Brendan they've always had, you know, and God willing, they'll never have to see that guy, you know, cause who I am is who I've always been. It was just clouded, like it says, by these, you know, other things that were going on. So I'm grateful for 30 years. I'm grateful for you guys. And I really mean, like, there are definitely people in here. You are my heroes, believe me. And I know you didn't ask to be that, but you are. Thank you.
Thanks, Brendan. Thanks everybody for being here. Next week, our speaker is Stephen M. So please come and support Stephen. And then the next week is our Halloween party.
Who's the speaker that night?
That speaker that night is Nancy S. So there will be pulled pork sandwiches, it says, speaker Nancy S. Then a s'mores bar. Anyways, here's that flyer if you're interested.